Wednesday, July 21st, 2021. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from the Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado. And we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. Hope your week is off to a strong start. Hope you, your family, your friends, you're all staying healthy. I know we're starting to hear again about some of these spikes popping up with COVID and variants and all those things. It's all right. Make sure you're taking care of yourself. Make sure you're, you know, getting vaccinated. Make sure you're getting some sunshine. You're getting some exercise. Make sure you're taking those vitamins and that you are staying healthy and keeping those around you healthy. We are happy to have you here with us today. And you know, we do need to wish a very happy birthday. Well, not actually today. It's a guy that actually has his birthday tomorrow, but it's a guy that is very underrated in the history of the National Football League. You know, he retired from playing back in 2004. So then, I mean, you have to wait, what, like 5 years? And then you get the call from the Pro Football Hall of Fame and you get your plaque and you get inducted, right? Okay, so he was eligible in what, like 2009, I guess? So please tell me, why in the world it took another 5 or 6 years for Tim Brown to get elected into the Hall of Fame? Tim Brown turns 55 years old tomorrow, as he was born on July 22nd, 1966. He was born down in Dallas, Texas. And what's crazy is that Tim Brown actually didn't play football as a freshman in high school. He was forbidden to play football by his mother. So instead, he played in the Woodrow Wilson High School band during his freshman year. But then he joined the Woodrow football team as a sophomore, although he initially tried to hide that he was playing it all from his mom. She later found out about it when the band leader would call Tim Brown's house and ask why he wasn't coming to band practice. Now, despite his outstanding contributions to the Woodrow Wilson High School football program, their team wasn't very good. I mean, they had a 4-25-1 record over his 3 years as a starter. Not like a winning program. And yet, recruiters could see Tim Brown was a special talent. And he was heavily recruited by a number of major colleges. He took his 5 official visits to some big-time schools. Of course, he went to Notre Dame. He went to Nebraska, Oklahoma, SMU, and the University of Iowa. Now, keep in mind, while at Woodrow Wilson High School, Tim Brown was also a standout track athlete. He was one of the state's top performers in the 400-meter dash. He actually had a personal record of 47.14 seconds, and he cleared 7.42 meters in the long jump event. So, I mean, these colleges were looking at Tim Brown and saying, this guy is an amazing athlete. Of course, we know Tim Brown chose the University of Notre Dame and he played there from 1984 till 1987, where he scored so many touchdowns, he was actually known by the nickname Touchdown Timmy. Brown was named an All-American twice. He also won the 1987 Heisman Trophy, becoming the very first wide receiver ever to win that award. He was then selected by the Los Angeles Raiders with the 6th pick of the 1988 NFL draft. And in his first NFL season, he was kind of still trying to figure out the wide receiver position, but he led the league in kickoff returns, return yardage, and yards per return average. Tim Brown would go on to play 17 seasons in the NFL. He caught over 1,000 passes for nearly 15,000 yards. He scored 105 touchdowns. And here's the biggest key, at least for me, with Tim Brown. I mean, you look at those numbers, you say, okay, 1,000 passes, yeah, that's pretty good. 15,000 yards, yeah, that's pretty good. 105 touchdowns, yeah, that's pretty good. You know, those numbers are pretty comparable to some other Hall of Fame wide receivers in that era. We know that in certain eras, these numbers tend to, you know, go up and down. In that era, yeah, these are Hall of Fame type numbers, except for this. Except that it's really, really hard to name any of the quarterbacks that threw the ball to Tim Brown, because most of his quarterbacks were pretty terrible. I want you to think about some of the quarterbacks that were throwing the ball to Tim Brown while he played for the Los Angeles and then later Oakland Raiders. Guys like Jay Schrader, Steve Berline, Jeff Hostetler, Jeff George, Vince Evans, Billy Joe Hobert, Donald Hollis, Bobby Hoying. I mean, the best guy he ever played with was Rich Gannon. Rich Gannon is above average, but Rich Gannon is hardly like a Hall of Famer or even close. That's not an all-time great throwing him the ball. That was the best Tim Brown ever had. To produce the numbers he did with that group throwing him the ball, no, that's pretty impressive stuff there. But here is something else that I want you to keep in mind when you think of Tim Brown. You know how there are certain athletes that we remember finishing their career in a different uniform? And you're like, I didn't really remember that. Like, that's kind of weird to me. We have guys like Franco Harris played one of his last seasons in the NFL with the Seattle Seahawks. Franco in Seattle blue? Just seemed weird. Or Patrick Ewing, the longtime center for the New York Knicks. He finished his career with the Orlando Magic. That's just kind of weird, right? Joe Namath playing for the Los Angeles Rams. That's just not what we picture when we think back to these guys' careers, is it? Of course not. And yet we have another one here with Tim Brown. Because we kind of forget that after playing 16 seasons with the Raiders, playing in the silver and black, you might have forgot that Tim Brown actually finished his career in 2004 as a member of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Yes, Tim Brown was all pewter power playing with the Bucs in his last year. That's a trivia question answer for you, by the way. Where did Tim Brown finish his career? I guess the Raiders, right? Nope. He finished it in Tampa Bay. Happy birthday to touchdown Timmy Brown, who turns 55 years of age tomorrow. Hey, if you'd like to contact the show, maybe tell us, I don't know, your favorite sports trivia question. We'd love to hear from you. Hit us up on email, dailydosports@gmail.com, or go find us over on Facebook or Twitter. Both of those handles are at dailydosports. Maybe you're bored. Maybe you actually have a trivia question. Maybe you just want to talk sports. Maybe you have a question for us. Reach out to us. We would love to hear what you have to say. Also, be sure that you do stop by dailydosports.com and check out some of the new articles that are going up there every week. I am doing my best to get back to writing a Daily Doses article every week. It usually has a little bit more of a local slant, but I'll be honest, it could be about anything. And then we also have our featured columnist, Young Jimmy, posting a new article every single Thursday. He's talked about a number of things. Talks about baseball quite a bit. He talked a little bit about the College Baseball World Series. He's talked about UFC and Conor McGregor. This last week, he actually looked at some of the bigger disappointments we've seen in Major League Baseball at the All-Star break. So you'll want to make sure you stop by dailydosports.com and check out some of the things that are going on over there. Plus, we always have a link to the podcast. We always have a link to the YouTube video. You can find some things even about the host over there that you might not have known. So make sure you stop by dailydosports.com. Also, as long as we're all still doing that online shopping, and we know we are, be sure you stop by tpublic.com and pick up some Daily Dose gear. We've got a number of designs for you to choose from our standard Daily Dose logo. You can get a basketball logo. You can get a football logo. A number of different things you can get over at tpublic.com. And the best thing about ordering clothing, you can get it in whatever color you want. If you need a specific color for a certain event, or you like the way you look in a specific color, go to tpublic.com, get a Daily Dose t-shirt, sweatshirt, or hoodie, and pick it in that color that everyone says you look so good in. Make sure you stop by tpublic.com. They're always doing a number of deals. Hey, today on the show, we actually have a number of news stories that have come out over the past week. We need to discuss those, including the latest on what's going on those NBA finals. Plus, you might not realize this, but NFL training camps are beginning to open this week already. Yeah, that's coming fast. And while that is great news, and we're all excited for the NFL season, well, we also have a little bit of bad news for you too. Going to discuss a few things in the NFL today on the show. But of course, we need to start off with those NBA finals. The Milwaukee Bucks win their first NBA title since 1971 last night as they finish off the Phoenix Suns in Game 6, 105-98, behind, let's be real clear, the most dominant player in the league right now, Giannis Antetokounmpo. I mean, when you think about it, Giannis is the best player probably in the league. He is definitely the best player in that series. And, you know, it is really, really hard to beat the best player in a seven-game basketball series because they can just control too much. And that's exactly what we saw from Giannis. He controlled things at the offensive end. He controlled things at the defensive end. Giannis last night goes for 50 points and 14 rebounds in the series clinching game. And, you know, down these last few series for the Bucks, it just seems like Giannis has stepped up his game even more. It almost seemed like when Kevin Durant stepped on that three-point line, remember back in the second round, and we were in the game seven, and Kevin Durant steps on the three-point line, and it's a two instead of a three. It just kind of seemed like that flipped a switch for Giannis. He was absolutely dominant against the Hawks. He was absolutely dominant against the Suns. For some reason, that seemed to give Giannis Antetokounmpo some life, some confidence, and he was absolutely rolling against the Phoenix Suns. But, you know, where the Milwaukee Bucks won this series wasn't at the offensive end, as good at times as they were. No, it was at the defensive end. The Bucks had too much length. They contested every single shot. I mean, when you think about how Phoenix was beating teams over in the Western Conference, they love that corner three-pointer. It is the shortest three in the game, and they kill teams with it. But not against Milwaukee. And I mean, last night in Game 6 was just another example. Because last night, the Bucks hold Phoenix to just 6 of 24 from three-point range. And you know, this title run by Milwaukee, it proves that basketball really is a pretty simple game. I know we like to make it more complex. I know that people like to talk about it like it's rocket science. It's really not. Here's the thing about basketball. If you get better shots than the other team, you'll probably make more of those shots. If you get more shots than the other team, again, then you will probably make more shots. Think about that, though. Milwaukee's interior defense and their ability to chase the Suns off of that three-point line, it forced the Suns to take tough shots. Think about some of the shots that Phoenix made. Even some of the ones they made were contested, really tough, off-balance, hand-in-your-face, falling-down kind of shots. So, Milwaukee got better shots. They got easier shots than Phoenix did. And then, because of the Bucks' rebounding ability at both ends of the floor, Milwaukee also got more shots than Phoenix. The Bucks averaged 8 more rebounds per game over this 6-game series. That adds up. That's almost 50 more rebounds over the series. When Phoenix had to get a stop, they must have a stop on this possession. We've got to get a stop. This has to be an empty possession for Milwaukee. How many times did we see Milwaukee miss a shot, but then they would sneak in for an offensive board and keep the possession alive? So many more times, Milwaukee got better shots. So many more times, Milwaukee got more shots. And I do have to give a few other Bucks players some big-time credit. I mean, how good was Chris Middleton in this series? He was clutch all series. So many times when Milwaukee had to have a big shot, he was the guy that knocked it down. Bobby Portis was very, very good. I know Bobby Portis always looks surprised with those big owl eyes of his, but he made a lot of big plays. Jrue Holiday really played Devin Booker well throughout the series, made him work for everything that he got. And then again, Giannis was amazing. He was absolutely amazing. But he did get some help. But talking about Milwaukee, and hey, all credit to Milwaukee, we do have to talk a little bit about the Phoenix Suns, don't we? Because that was an incredible run they were on by a team that, remember, This was a team that was down for so many years. They were bad for so many years, totally rebuilt. Chris Paul comes in this last year. All of a sudden, they're in the finals. They look like they might be able to win it. Remember, Phoenix was up in this series 2-0. They looked like they had all the answers. What happened? Milwaukee runs off 4 straight. Well, a few things happen. One, like we talked about, the best player in the series absolutely took over. The Suns had no answer for Giannis whatsoever. And the Bucks gave the Suns a ton of problems with their length and their defense. And also, Chris Paul played good, but I don't know that you could say he played great down the stretch of these past 4 games. And he had some really, really crucial mistakes, some really bad turnovers. Now, I don't think Chris Paul is fully healthy, but I don't know if Chris Paul is ever fully healthy. I did, though, and I have to mention this, I did find it a little bit odd that last night, the NBA assigned Scott Foster to officiate a series clinching game. I mean, they do have other refs, right? It's not like Scott Foster is this great ref. Nobody really likes the guy, but considering his history with Chris Paul, now Chris Paul drops to what, 1-13 in playoff games with Scott Foster reffing? I thought that was odd. It almost made me think that the NBA didn't want the series to go back to Phoenix. I mean, of course, we're not going to believe that, right? I mean, who are you going to believe? The NBA, which has like less credibility than boxing judges, or your own lying eyes? But fortunately, Game 6 last night did not come down to officiating. It was still odd to see the league do that. Hey, Chris Paul, like I said, was good in this series. He was not great, and the Suns needed him to be great. And it wasn't just Chris Paul. Devin Booker really struggled to find his groove from game to game, and they kept him uncomfortable. Even when he had big games. I mean, you think back to Game 5, when Devin Booker goes out and he scores 40, he still really had to work for that 40. He still had to put up a lot of shots, and we saw him trying to do too much. He fails to come up with the clutch play down the stretch. Instead, he turns it over with the game on the line. I mean, the Bucks hold Booker last night to just 19 points on 8 of 22 shooting. That's not going to bode well for Phoenix. And finally, the role players for the Suns, they didn't step up the way the role players stepped up for the Bucks. Well, the Bucks were getting clutch play from guys like Chris Middleton and Bobby Portis and Drew Holiday. The Suns needed guys like Jay Crowder and Mikal Bridges and Cameron Johnson to step up their game. And it seemed like the longer the series went, the more those guys seemed to disappear. So congratulations to the Milwaukee Bucks. Congratulations to their fans winning a title that was such a long time coming. Like I said, they hadn't won a title since back in 1971. It's been 50 years for the Milwaukee Bucks. Sure, the ratings were terrible. No one seemed to be watching these finals at all, but it ended up being a reasonably fun series. And you know what? Good for Milwaukee. Good for their fans. And I will give their fans this. Milwaukee fans do support like crazy. They do tune into these games. You saw the crowd up there. Well, maybe you didn't. I'll tell you. There was a crowd up there outside of the arena that was absolutely insane. So congrats to the Milwaukee Bucks and their fans. Huge, huge win for them. By the way, Las Vegas odds are out already for next season. And the Brooklyn Nets are the favorite going into the season, followed by the Los Angeles Lakers, then those Milwaukee Bucks, and for some reason, the Golden State Warriors. Really? Golden State? Now remember, Vegas doesn't care who wins. Vegas only cares who bets. But I'm not sure Golden State should be in that conversation. It will be interesting to see how the NBA offseason shapes up. Remember, the NBA draft will be coming up soon, and we will see how these teams look going into next season. Okay, coming back, we actually have a number of other sports news stories that we need to still get to this week. Major League Baseball had a really scary situation over the weekend. The NFL is making some odd moves, let's say, and college football is taking a really hard line on one specific rule. Well, I guess that's not fair. Not really, But they are kind of talking about a hard line on one specific rule. We'll explain what we're talking about when we get back. You know, we do have some more sports news that we need to touch on this week. Couple of other stories coming out besides just in the NBA that I kind of wanted to share with you. And let's start off in Major League Baseball, where we had a truly terrifying situation on Saturday night in Washington, D.C., when the top half of the sixth inning in the game between the San Diego Padres and the Washington Nationals, it had actually just ended in front of a little over 30,000 fans, when several shots were heard from an incident that occurred on South Capitol Street just outside the third base side of the stadium. And a chaotic scene quickly developed at the game. As the Padres cleared the field, some fans began rushing to leave the stadium, while other fans were ducking and trying to hide, looking for some cover against they weren't really sure what. The game had to be suspended at that point. It would be resumed on Sunday ahead of the regularly scheduled game that was already going to be there on Sunday. The shooting, an exchange of gunfire between people in two cars, left three people injured, according to the Metro Police Department. One of the people who shot was actually a woman who was attending the game and who was struck while she was just outside the stadium. They say her injuries weren't considered life-threatening. Two people who were in the stadium later actually walked into a local hospital with gunshot wounds and were being questioned by investigators. But the extent of their injuries wasn't immediately clear. Investigators were still trying to locate the second vehicle that was involved in the shooting. They're still trying to figure out exactly who that was. But like I said, this was a truly horrible situation where people are out acting crazy and terrorizing innocent families, and you have people just trying to go to the game, and they're not sure what's going on. Is someone targeting us? Is someone trying to do another public crazy shooting? You don't know. You're in the stands and you kind of feel like you're a sitting target. It wasn't a good situation on Saturday night when people are terrorizing innocent families. Then again, this did take place in Washington, D.C., where we see people acting crazy and terrorizing innocent families pretty much every day, just in a different way. But it does seem like it happens a lot in that part of our country. You know, shockwaves of this situation were felt around the league throughout Major League Baseball. The Los Angeles Dodgers actually came out with a statement that they said it would be horrifying if that same thing happened in Chavez Ravine. They said they're way more used to stabbings in Chavez Ravine. Gunfire? No, that would be scary. The Miami Marlins players stated on social media that an active shooter situation at Lone Depot Park in their home stadium would really be dangerous because there wouldn't be any fans in attendance for players to even hide behind. Meanwhile, the Houston Astros also weighed in on what their response would be upon hearing gunshots. And Astros second baseman Jose Altuve asked, well, I got to think about that. Are gunshots the signal for a slider or for a curveball? I can't remember what it was. See, trash can lid was fastball. Gunshots, I think it was an outside slider, but I'm not sure. Either way, I know I can swing. Things are a little bit different in Houston. Like, we've kind of forgotten about that, but things down in Houston, they're a little bit odd. Speaking of having a bad week, you know, you may have had a bad week last week. Yes, I'm looking right at you, LeBron James, with your new Space Jam being called one of the worst movies since, like, Cats.
Oh, no, you didn't.
But odds are, even if you were LeBron James, you didn't have as bad of a week as veteran NFL cornerback Richard Sherman. According to documents filed by the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office on Friday in Seattle, the charges against Mr. Richard Sherman include two domestic violence counts, criminal trespassing in the second degree, and malicious mischief in the third degree, along with resisting arrest, driving while under the influence, and reckless endangerment of roadway workers. The charges are all misdemeanors. They are punishable by up to 90 days in jail, or gross misdemeanors punishable by up to 1 year in jail. This all happened after Sherman's wife had to call 911 last week because Sherman was arrested early Wednesday after police say he crashed his car in a construction zone along a busy highway east of Seattle. Then he somehow got to his in-law's home in Redmond, Washington, a suburb of Seattle, and tried to break in the door. That's not good. Sherman's father-in-law told officers that he had actually armed himself with a handgun and had fired pepper spray as Sherman tried to break down the door with his shoulder. We saw it on video from their video surveillance camera. Now, Richard Sherman is 33. He is entering what should be his 10th season in the NFL. He was hoping to sign with a team in the coming weeks as training camp nears as an unrestricted free agent. However, I mean, after seeing this and finding out this guy's got some serious demons, this guy's got some serious problems, he says that he has some mental health issues. Well, if you hear that as an NFL team, I mean, you kind of have to put all that on hold, right? For one, now you have to wait and see, well, what happens with his case? Is he even going to be available to play? And then what will the league do upon finding that out as well? Could he be on suspension? Could he be in that player conduct situation where he wouldn't even be available to play? Hey, make no mistake, all this stuff happening to Richard Sherman last week is a big hit to his reputation, who had a reputation for being pretty fiery, sometimes saying some controversial things, but he always seemed to keep his personal life in order. He takes a big hit there. But more importantly, he's going to take a big hit to his wallet as he was looking for a new NFL deal. If you are a team right now, you're looking at him going, yeah, let's kind of wait. I'm not sure we want to sign you just yet. Richard Sherman had a really, really bad week last week. But here is a question that I want to ask you that I want you to think about. I know that the NFL is king and the NFL season is coming quickly. We're going to be talking about it a little bit later in the show. But do you think the NFL watches the NBA, watches the NBA and how they operate, watches the NBA ratings at all? I mean, I would think that they do. But then I also kind of wonder, when you watch, are you paying attention? Like, are you learning much when you watch? And here's why I ask that. Because the NFL announced last week that they plan to add more social justice messaging to fields, to player helmets, and their pregame activities. That is according to Front Office Sports. They report it's all part of a 10-year, $250 million commitment to combat systemic racism. Well, I mean, that sounds like a good thing, right? The site reports that the league will push social justice messages via on-field signage, via decals on player helmets, and even in-stadium public service announcements. The league also plans to make the Black National Anthem a prominent part of all NFL events. Now, in September 2020, the NFL used a video of Alicia Keys singing the song Lift Every Voice and Sing at stadiums around the league. Now, personally, I think the NFL should be very, very careful here. We have seen politics really hurt the NBA product. We have seen people begin to shy away from that league. I don't know that this is a very wise business choice. But that's not what I want to talk about today. Let's go back to that other part. Let's go back to that Black National Anthem. Is that a thing? I didn't know there were different national anthems. More importantly, do other races also get their own national anthem? Let's think about that. Let me see if I have this straight, because maybe I have this mixed up. Sometimes I get confused. Is the Star Spangled Banner like the white national anthem? I would think that would be more like Sweet Caroline if you were picking a white song, but maybe that's just me. Okay, so we have the white national anthem covered with the Star Spangled Banner, right? And then we have the black, apparently, national anthem covered with Lift Every Voice and Sing. But it's not just white players and black players in the NFL. I mean, what about the Hispanic players? Do they get their own national anthem? And more important, if they do, what song would we be picking for them? No. Do not start playing Lowrider. Turn that off. We're going to get in trouble for that. Don't play that. That could be deemed offensive somehow. I don't know what the Hispanic national anthem would be, but I would think if we're going to have national anthems for different races, we got to come up with something, don't we? And, you know, there are also a few NFL players that are like Hawaiian or Pacific Islander. What would their national anthem be? Like, do we break out a little Don Ho for those players? There are a few players that are of Asian descent in the NFL. They're going to need their own national anthem too. And I mean, does it just stop at races? Or do we go into other things? I mean, we know that Las Vegas Raider defensive player Carl Nassib just came out over the past month or so to say that he is gay. He announced that on his social media platform. Do we have to have another national anthem for gay players? No. Don't play YMCA. We're going to get kicked off of YouTube if you play YMCA. Turn that off. I don't know what the gay national anthem would be. I'm just saying these are some things we need to think about if we're going to start designating everyone getting their own national anthem. Now, maybe I'm confused because I thought just as a country, you had one national anthem and that was it. But now I'm finding out we have a lot of different variants upon this national anthem. It's confusing to me. I don't know exactly how that all works. I mean, I know that we're being told that this is all in the name of unity. This is all in the name of togetherness. I'm just not exactly sure how playing like 19 national anthems prior to every single game is going to bring any of us together. And here's another question to think about. Let's say you play one of those national anthems. Can you kneel for them? Is there any kneeling going on? Like if we play YMCA, does anyone take a knee? Or is that just okay? Are you just out there doing the dance? I don't know how that works. But I could see all this eventually being really problematic and being really, really confusing. I am warning the NFL right now. Be very careful. Be very careful. It seems like we're going down a path that could have more problems than solutions. I mean, at some point, don't we all kind of just see, okay, these leagues are just going to say, forget it. We're not even playing a national anthem anymore. We've got 47 national anthems keyed up. We don't have enough time. The anthems take longer than the games. Just never mind. We just won't play it anymore. I think that's where it's going. And so eventually the teams will just come out. We'll play Smash Mouth All-Star and we'll just kick it off, right? Isn't that where this is all heading? Now, I know when we hear this stuff, we say, you know, the NFL might be going down a bad path. And yet I know we all kind of think, yeah, but the NFL's king. Here in the States, the NFL is king. Like baseball struggles to get any ratings. The NBA can't get anybody to watch their product. A lot of sports are really, really struggling to get ratings. And yet you turn on a Thursday night game in the NFL. It's, I don't know, the Jaguars and the Jets, and you still get like 20 million viewers. That's just how it is. And I know we all think the NFL is untouchable. They can do this stuff if they want to. And it should be untouchable. But I also know that at one point in this country, that's what baseball thought. They thought they were untouchable. And now you can barely pay people to watch baseball. The NFL needs to be very, very careful going down a very dangerous path. Moving over to college football, it seems that two college football programs are closing a deal to finalize a three-game series to prove once and for all who rules the Sunshine State. No, I'm not talking about Florida State and Miami. I'm not talking about even Florida and Miami. No. This is a different rivalry that we are going to be seeing. This is going to be a rivalry between the former national champion Central Florida Knights and the Florida Gators. Now, co-national champions back in 2017, and by co-national champions, I mean they just decided to call themselves co-national champions based on absolutely nothing. Anyways, the UCF Knights appear that they are ready to start playing some out-of-conference teams that are maybe a notch above teams like Marshall or like South Carolina State. And UCF has decided that they're going to start off in lowly Gainesville with the Gators. Could Tallahassee or maybe even a stop in Miami be next? Stay tuned. It could happen. According to the Orlando Sentinel, UCF and the University of Florida are signing a contract for a three-game series, with two of the games being in Gainesville and one of the games being played in Orlando at UCF. Now, you might remember this idea was actually lobbed out a year or two ago, but UCF balked at it and said, well, we don't want to do this if it's going to be two games in Gainesville and then only one at our place. And then everyone pretty much just made fun of UCF and said, hey, if you want to play the big dogs, go play the big dogs and stop griping about things. Go bump up your strength of schedule, and then you can claim whatever you want. But you can't claim that you're co-national champions when you didn't play anyone in the top 25 all year. So now they have decided they are going to make this happen. UCF is out to prove that they are on the same plane with the big boys. They are going to be playing the SEC's Florida Gators. So get ready for that, folks. And by get ready, I mean tell your children and, I don't know, maybe your grandchildren to get ready, because this actually isn't scheduled to start until 2024. That will be played in Gainesville. Then they'll play again in 2030. That will be in Orlando. And then the final game of the series will be back in Gainesville. That will be in 2033. Yes, you heard me correctly. The final game of the series won't be until 2033. I mean, hey folks, that is a full 16 years after UCF's big self-proclaimed championship. That's a long time out. We will see if the Central Florida Knights are still chasing the big dogs by then, or if they have established themselves as a true power down in the state of Florida by then. Finally, just when you thought you had seen it all in the Big 12's war on players, taunting Texas players with that horns down sign, along comes the Big 12 coordinator of officials, Greg Burks. And Greg is going to make things way worse by throwing some words into this ruling when trying to clarify the league's sportsmanship rule. Last week at Big 12 Media Days, when asked about the rules, Greg told media members that if an opposing player taunts opposing Texas players with a horns down sign with their hands, you know, it will probably be a penalty. What? Greg, what are you talking about? What does probably mean, bro? Is it a penalty or is it not a penalty? That should be pretty easy to answer. But wait, Greg wasn't finished. When asked if an opposing player would get a penalty for making that blasphemous horns down hand gesture to his own fan base, Greg said that it probably would not be a penalty. I'm not even joking about this. This is what Greg said. It's all on video. However, Greg also added that it is always a possibility that it could be a penalty. Can someone please tell us what the Big 12 is doing? Can someone please explain to us why Texas is somehow so sacred? I mean, people do the mock Gator Chomp. They do the mock Wichita State Shocker. They do the mock Miami U, the mock V for Victory to Southern California. People make fun of opponents' fight songs. They point out how long it has been since Michigan has beaten Ohio State. There are even some crazy fans out there. Sometimes at games, they will hold up their middle fingers to opposing teams. And yeah, all those things are fine. But for some reason, horns down is the ultimate desecration of all that is good and holy. I'll tell you what this is doing. One, it's making the Big 12 and Texas look like a bunch of whiny crybabies. But two, it is making horns down way more popular for fans, way more popular for players. Now, players might get penalized for it, but fans? Oh, they're doing that all the time. They're going to be flashing that every single chance they get. It's on social media. It's in the stands. It's on their t-shirts. It's on their sweatshirts. Horns down is everywhere. And it's really thanks to Texas whining about it, and thanks to the Big 12 actually trying to step in and having some sort of rules about it. Who cares if people make the horns and put them down? How did that suddenly become this vile desecration of everything good in college football? I don't get it. I understand they're trying to stop the taunting. Is that even really taunting? It just seems kind of silly. Well done, Texas, and well done, Big 12.
Congratulations, you played yourself.
Okay, coming back, we need to get over to our Daily Dose Top 5. You know, we mentioned it earlier, but rookies and injured veterans that are in like rehab situations in the National Football League, they begin to report to training camps tomorrow. Keep in mind, veterans will be showing up in just another week. Training camp is coming. That is super exciting, right? The NFL will be back. And soon, preseason games will be starting. The regular season will be close behind. What could possibly be wrong with any of that? Well, our Daily Dose Top 5 will tell you one thing that's a little bit scary about it when we get back. Now, as we do so many weeks here at the Daily Dose, we need to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. You know, the NFL season is coming quickly. Football is going to be here before we know it. And I'll be honest, I can't wait. I know the NFL is kind of getting in bed with some weird causes that might cause problems, but I'm excited for the NFL season. I mean, think about it. The season has been expanded now to 17 games. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers are going to be a favorite to repeat, but honestly, the field is going to be pretty wide open. We know anything can happen in the NFL. Anything can happen in football. Now, tomorrow, players who are rehabbing previous injuries and rookies are expected to arrive at training camp and begin to prepare for a long, grueling season. Then veterans will begin reporting next week to NFL training camps. I mean, aside from the NFL kind of shoving their wokeness down our collective throats, is there any reason to not get excited for the coming season? Well, yes. Unfortunately, there is. Because every single year, as NFL training camps open, we see the same thing. Players get injured. Players get hurt. You hope it doesn't happen. You hope it doesn't happen to your team, at least. But players do go down. And sometimes, it's actually pretty serious. Today, our Daily Dose Top 5 is looking back at the unfortunate side of the NFL preseason as we are counting down the top five NFL training camp injuries. And I'm telling you right now, there are some bad ones here that really changed a lot of things. Let's start off at number five. And for number five, we will go back to the year 2013. The Philadelphia Eagles were actually coming off of a really rough season. They had gone 4-12. They were hoping to get it together and to improve under their head coach, Andy Reid. They had quarterback Michael Vick. And Michael Vick had a few weapons at his disposal. I mean, he had a very young running back by the name of LeSean McCoy. He had a very dangerous wide receiver by the name of DeSean Jackson. And he had another wide receiver that was coming into his own a little bit. This guy had 67 catches in 2012. He had 857 yards and he had 7 touchdowns. And the Eagles were actually counting on Jeremy Maclin to step up and have another big season. The Eagles knew our offense is going to have to score some points this year. Unfortunately, in training camp, in a 7-on-7 drill, Jeremy Maclin's knee would buckle. He would suffer a blown ACL in his right knee. He would miss the entire 2013 season. Now, the Eagles would go on to have a pretty good year. They went 10-6. They even made it to the wild card round of the playoffs. But I mean, if you think back to what they lost, if they had Jeremy Maclin, he probably would have helped them be even better than that. They might have gone further than that. Now, Maclin would eventually come back in 2014. He had a really good year after his injury. He caught 85 passes. He had over 1,300 yards. He caught 10 touchdowns in 2014. And what he did was he used that explosive season in 2014 to show teams around the league, hey, I'm a better. I'm fine. I'm still capable of being a big-time player. And it just so happened that he ended up getting his free agency. So he got a new deal with the Kansas City Chiefs in 2015. But the Philadelphia Eagles, losing Jeremy Maclin in 2013, I mean, that just wasn't how Philadelphia wanted to start that season. You want to keep everyone healthy. You want to make sure you are firing with everything you have when the season started. And that is not what the Eagles got that year in 2013. And it comes in for us today at number five. We move on to number four. And we go back to 2001. Now, the Baltimore Ravens had won the Super Bowl back in the year 2000. And after that season, going into 2001, we actually had a brand new show coming out from HBO. It was going to be called Hard Knocks. And Hard Knocks was going to follow a team through training camp and give us viewers like a view behind the scenes. What goes on in the locker room? What goes on in the coaches' offices? How do the coaches decide who to cut, who to play, who's higher on the depth chart? We were going to see all those things. We were going to hear inside the huddle. We were going to learn so much about the Baltimore Ravens coming off of their Super Bowl season. Well, one player that had helped the Ravens win the Super Bowl in 2000 was rookie running back Jamal Lewis. And Jamal Lewis looked like he was poised for another big year in his sophomore season. Lewis had over 1,300 yards and 6 touchdowns as a rookie as he helped Baltimore win the Super Bowl. So now, he's back for year number 2. He's hoping to do bigger and better things. We know a lot of times that NFL running backs make a ton of progress after that first season. Now they're not having to think. Now things are more automatic. They can just play. Unfortunately, on Hard Knocks, in training camp, Jamal Lewis went down with a knee injury, and everyone at the time thought, well, it's just a bruised knee. It's not a big deal. And then Jamal Lewis had the unfortunate luck to have the world actually witnessing as he and his team found out it wasn't just a knee bruise. It was a torn ACL in his left knee. Jamal Lewis would miss the entire 2001 season, didn't get to play a single snap. Now, fortunately for him, he actually came back stronger than ever. He rushed for over 2,000 yards in 2002. He led the league in rushing, and he actually fell just 39 yards short of breaking Eric Dickerson's all-time single-season record. Jamal Lewis came back even better than he had been. He would go on to play 3 more seasons for the Baltimore Ravens. He would eventually finish his career off by playing for the Cleveland Browns, and Jamal Lewis would retire after the 2009 season. But back in 2001, many of us remember on Hard Knocks, Jamal Lewis going down with that knee injury and their organization finding out, yeah, he's done for the year, even though we haven't even gone out in a preseason game yet. We haven't even played in training camp. Jamal Lewis was already done for the year. We move on to number 3. And again, we go back to 2013, which apparently was a tough year for NFL training camps. And again, we go to the Baltimore Ravens. Sorry, Ravens. This was 12 years later, but this happened to the Baltimore Ravens again. Back in 2013, the Baltimore Ravens had a good young tight end that seemed to be improving every single season. The Ravens had selected BYU tight end Dennis Pitta in 2010, and after he kind of redshirted his rookie year, Pitta started to produce. Pitta caught 150 passes in 2011 and 12 for over 1,000 yards and 10 touchdowns. And Dennis Pitta was becoming a big-time target in the Ravens passing game. But in 2013, in training camp, Dennis Pitta went down with a dislocated hip that totally changed his career. It happened in training camp. It happened without any contact whatsoever. Pitta stretched out for a catch in a drill. He made it. And when he got up, he couldn't put any weight on his leg. His hip had come out of the socket. Dennis Pitta would miss most of the 2013 season. He would then return for 4 games at the end of the year. He made 20 catches and looked pretty good, but the hip kept bothering him. It bothered him in 2014. He missed another 13 games. Then he missed the entire 2015 season. Finally, in 2016, Dennis Pitta returned healthy and he was back to his dominant self. He caught 86 passes for 729 yards in 2016. So in 2017, Dennis Pitta is going to be back. He's going to be even better, right? He's going to build on what we have already seen him do, right? Well, actually, no. Because in 2017, It happened again. It happened in training camp. It happened without contact. Dennis Pitta dove for a pass. He made the catch and his hip came out of the socket and dislocated again. Dennis Pitta would never play in the NFL again. It's a really, really sad story because he looked like he might be a promising young tight end. Unfortunately, Dennis Pitta's injury in training camp, not even on the field in play, in training camp, comes in for us today at number 3. We move on to number 2 on our list today. And entering the 2006 NFL season, we had a young player that was actually showing promise of maybe becoming an NFL superstar. LeCharles Bentley was drafted in the second round of the 2002 NFL draft by the New Orleans Saints. He actually signed a 4-year deal worth nearly $3 million. Now, he had excelled at the guard position as a rookie, and he had started 14 games. He was actually named Sports Illustrated's Offensive Rookie of the Year in 2002. He was named to Pro Football Weekly's All-Rookie Team. Really strong start for Bentley. In his second season, Bentley started in 13 games, and this time, he earned a spot in the 2003 Pro Bowl. Hey, this is a good young offensive lineman. In the 2004 season, the New Orleans Saints actually moved him from guard, where he had been playing so far, back to his original position of center, where he had played at Ohio State in college. And Bentley still looked great. He started all 16 games. He went on to be voted as an alternate to the 2004 Pro Bowl at center. So now he has made the Pro Bowl in 2 different positions. And he's only, what, 3 or 4 years in? This kid is going to be a phenomenal player. He just keeps proving he is an elite talent. It doesn't matter. He can kind of play anywhere on the offensive line. He's so versatile. He has a really, really bright future. In 2005, Bentley started 14 games at center for the Saints. And once again, Bentley was voted to the Pro Bowl. But after the 2005 season, he announced he wanted to get out of New Orleans. He didn't want to play for the Saints franchise. In fact, he said he would rather sit out the season than play with the New Orleans Saints franchise again. So Bentley hit free agency. And after originally signing a contract with Philadelphia that kind of fell through, he signed with his dream team in his home state of Ohio. LeCharles Bentley would sign with the Cleveland Browns, the team he had grown up watching as a kid. Now he's going to get to go back there. He's going to strengthen a team that he's always cheered for and in a position that we know the Cleveland Browns have needed for years and years and years. But then LeCharles Bentley's career took a drastic change. It was altered when LeCharles Bentley suffered a ruptured patellar tendon in his knee during the very first 11-on-11 drills in training camp that year for the Browns. Now, as bad as that was, it was later revealed that after the injury, Bentley also contracted a staph infection. He required 4 surgeries following the injury, and he said that the staph infection was so bad, they nearly had to amputate his leg. There were days, they say, that LeCharles Bentley's life was in danger. He might not make it. He was so bad off. He ended up actually suing the Cleveland Browns over the infection that he received, but he later settled out of court in 2012. LeCharles Bentley spent months hospitalized. He underwent multiple surgeries to try to fix this. And after that horrible ordeal, LeCharles Bentley was forced to retire. He would never play another snap in the NFL. Here's a guy with a bright future, with a big contract, going back to his hometown to play for his home team. And it all ends in just a drill in training camp. Nothing really all that violent. You move wrong, you step wrong, you tweak something, and all of a sudden, not only does your season change, does your day change, your entire career changes. His life completely changed. LeCharles Bentley comes in on our tragic list today at number 2. So we reached the number 1 entry today on our Daily Dose top 5 list of NFL training camp injuries. And we have another one that was a major career changer. It was back in August of 2016, and the Minnesota Vikings had a good young quarterback that seemed to be getting better every year. After selecting Teddy Bridgewater in the first round of the 2014 NFL draft out of Louisville, Bridgewater was starting to look like he might be a star. I mean, he went just 6-6 as a rookie, but then in 2015, Teddy Bridgewater led the Minnesota Vikings to an 11-5 record. You might remember they lost a heartbreaker playoff game to the Seattle Seahawks that season. So, I mean, after that, this was a good young team. What is Teddy Bridgewater going to do next? But then, once again, in training camp, not in the drill, in practice.
We're talking about practice. Not a game. We're talking about practice.
In an 11-on-11 drill, at practice in August, Teddy Bridgewater suffered a brutal non-contact knee injury. They say that Bridgewater went to execute a play-action fake with running back Adrian Peterson. And when Bridgewater's left leg hit the ground on one of his just normal strides, it collapsed entirely. And as it turned out, Teddy Bridgewater essentially separated the upper part of his leg from the lower part of his leg, with the breaking point being his left knee. The injury is known as tibiofemoral dislocation. The femur and the tibia bones essentially become disconnected. That dislocation also led to the tearing of Bridgewater's left ACL, and shortly after Bridgewater's injury, Dr. Will Carroll appeared on local radio and said that Viking training staff had to save Teddy Bridgewater's life. Not his knee, not his leg, his life, because that tibiofemoral dislocation has the potential to break arteries and you bleed out before you can ever get to a hospital. Luckily for Teddy Bridgewater, all of his blood vessels remained intact despite the horrible injury, but he was out for about 15 months. He finally came in late in the 2017 season for the Minnesota Vikings, but the injury required two separate surgeries so that he could fully heal. He would eventually move on as a free agent to the New Orleans Saints. He played there for two seasons and basically didn't play much, but he got to sit back and watch Drew Brees. And then last year, Teddy Bridgewater became the full-time starter for the Carolina Panthers. He was below average, didn't really have a great year. And now, an off-season trade has Teddy Two-Glove here in Denver battling Drew Lock for the Denver Broncos starting job. Hey, make no mistake, these injuries happen every year. You just hope they're really not all that significant, that they're not career-changing, or that they're not life-threatening. I know a lot of times we hear NFL contracts and we go, man, those guys are so spoiled, they make so much money. But remember, in the NFL, where injuries are prevalent, your contract goes away like that if they want to cut you. You are always just a snap away from your entire world changing very quickly, as we saw today on our Daily Dose Top 5. Hey, let's hope that we have guys taking care of themselves this offseason, that teams and team doctors and team training personnel all help these players avoid some of these terrible injuries so that we can sit back and enjoy the NFL season that so many of us are looking forward to. I can't wait for the NFL season. I just know injuries are coming, and I just hope we don't see anything too serious this year. We can just get the stuff happening on the field that we all love every single fall. Hey, next week on The Dose, I told you that we have some very special and very different things for you this summer. With it being a slower time of year, I told you I was trying to put some things together that might be a little bit different than anything we've ever done. I am working on something completely different for you over the next few weeks. You're going to have to trust me on that. But I'm telling you right now, if they come to fruition, they could be pretty big. So be sure to tune in and be sure to tell a friend or two to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for subscribing to our YouTube channel. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and reading the articles, seeing the podcast, watching the videos over there. We appreciate that so much. But more than anything else, thank you so much for sharing the show, for sharing the articles, for sharing the videos with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.
We're talking about practice. Not a game. We're talking about practice.